Before I begin the formal talk this morning, most importantly, are there any questions about the practice of mindfulness of the breath, mindful breathing? Is there a little feedback on this or something? No, it's okay. Sounds okay. Must just be me. So again, any questions about the practice that we did today? Anybody who's new or not clear about how to practice mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath while sitting, while walking, as well as how to deal with the mind and the thoughts that arise in the mind? So you're all good, well experienced? Good. I'm impressed. So again, everybody knows what they're doing and clear about how to practice mindfulness. Good. So this morning, what I wanted to share with you, we recently came back from North Carolina. Every year we do a retreat up at a retreat center called Southern Dharma. There were a number of people from our Florida community who were there. And somebody asked if I could share a little bit from the teachings that we spent a week practicing. The text is called Naturally Liberating Whatever You Meet, Instructions to Guide You on the Profound Path by a Tibetan teacher who lived, into the late 50s, early 60s. It's not clear when he died. So fairly recent. And the interesting thing about this Kempo Gangshar is that Kempo is sort of a title, sort of like professor within the Buddhist monastic tradition. And he was a very well-known, very respected scholar, meditator, teacher, but very traditional. And this was about 1957, 56, 57, 58, when the Chinese communists had really developed a very strong and beginning repressive presence in Tibet, for those who know the history there. So anyhow, he's this kind of normal, very respected, traditional Kempo. And then he has what we might call a near-death experience. And even though the people who were around him thought he had died, because basically he was very ill and sick, and then he appeared to have died. Traditionally, they leave the body for at least 3 days. And after the second or third day, all of a sudden, he came out of it. and the interesting thing they say is he was changed. And one of his changes was it's all of a sudden he had seen very clearly what was going to unfold in Tibet with the Chinese communists taking over, and that they were going to be very clearly doing everything they can to utterly destroy and wipe out Buddhism in Tibet. So he realized these were extraordinary times and they cannot continue as they have been. And so he changed his whole teaching style, and teachings and practices that were given and developed over years and years to a practitioner, he gave in very direct, pithy teachings for everyone, monks, nuns, laymen, lay people, nomads, educated. He would give these practices and teachings to. He went up into the mountains to where a lot of the hermits and retreatants lived, and he told them to come down into the valleys to teach people, because he really felt that Buddhism was going to come to an end formally, in structurally, we might say, organizationally in Tibet. And the only thing that would preserve it would be that people practiced it in their minds. Okay, so very So this is one of his texts. There are only a few of them, a teaching he gave. And it really mostly deals with what's in Buddhism we call the nature of mind. But I won't get into that. That's something to be done on retreat. But I do want to share a section with you. So let me just say that the first section is called the General Preliminaries. And here, so he's expecting, now again, it's a different culture, but that in Tibet, that sort of everybody in the culture, educated, uneducated, was familiar with the basic teachings. In our case, that's not the case. So he sort of says, first of all, begin with the preliminaries. And what he's really talking about here is, and I won't go into it today, is that one basically kind of understands some of the fundamental teachings that help us understand what's going on in the world. These are teachings about impermanence, how everything is changing, how nothing is solid, nothing is stable, everything is totally in flux. And the second thing is, why are things in flux? Is there a reason? And that is causes and conditions, cause and effect. So the reflection on impermanence, the reflection on cause and effect or karma, and what's called the unsatisfactoriness of worldly life. Something here in America we have trouble with, but it really answers in these teachings why it is that even though we exert so much effort in this life to gain happiness through acquiring things, reputation, money, relationship, you know, that we go about it so, we work so hard to be happy. We think doing things that'll bring us happiness or bring us peace of mind, and yet it never arrives. There's a fundamental kind of unsatisfactory to this type of living, which in Buddhism is very much reflected on, the reasons why. And there's some other of these kinds of reflections that are so important that we kind of, even if we don't meditate, that we kind of have an understanding of why things are unfolding in life the way they are, and we can have understanding. And then there are more specific kind of preliminaries dealing with, understanding what a spiritual path is, a correct one from an incorrect, cultivating what's called an altruistic mind, which means a mind that is very aware that we're all in this together. And so I'm not only, I'm not just thinking about myself and my own happiness and my own ending of suffering, but I have an altruistic concern for the well-being of all, as well as various kinds of specific practices. So those are the ordinary preliminaries. But what I want to share with you today is what he calls the special preliminaries. And this is all within a section that is preliminary to the main practice, which is about understanding the nature of one's own mind. And it's interesting because it's sort of simplistic, which is kind of good for people like us because we tend to overthink things. And obviously, he's kind of taking the hearers. I mean, this was sort of a written teaching. And again, as I said to you, this was no longer just teaching very experienced monks and nuns and meditators, but he would teach this to everybody, uneducated, nomads, ordinary people. So he sort of works them through a thing. And he says, he basically, he begins by saying, that one first has to have an understanding about wholesome and unwholesome. We have to understand what are wholesome deeds, what are unwholesome deeds, right? So we can sort of understand that wholesome deeds produce wholesome effects and unwholesome deeds and actions produce unwholesome effects. It's kind of simple. He's saying, of course, if we want to be happy, if we want to be wholesome, if we want to have well-being within ourselves, we got to know the difference between those actions that create, that facilitate wholesomeness, which means happiness and peace of mind, and those that don't. If we don't know the difference, it's very hard for us to know, how to act, what to say, what to think. And then he, so he says, so that's the first thing. And then he says, in terms of the actions and the deeds, then he says, we have to decide, you know, what is most important in terms of knowing the wholesome from the unwholesome. Is it our body? Is it our speech or our mind? Traditionally in Buddhism, we say that's sort of, you know, that's who we are. We have, right? It's very simple. We have a physical body, we have a mind, but we also act in the world through words. And especially as lay people, we use lots of words. We speak to each other. So we have to understand that our actions in this world, our wholesome and unwholesome actions, are manifest through the deeds of our body, the deeds of our speech, and the deeds of our mind. And then he says, of these three, and then he goes through them, you know, what's most important? Again, you know, I'm just kind of going through it because we forget this. And obviously, if you reflect on it, you'd say, well, my body and my speech do not act independently. They are under the control of my mind. So if there's anything that I want to, you know, begin to gain control of, it is what? It is my mind, because as my mind is, so are the actions of my words and the actions of my body. And that's why I actually thought of Shantideva this morning. You think we think we always think the problem's out there, but the problem is us. So this was a good lesson. Okay, so it's all. Thank you. That is better. Good. There's a deep lesson in that one. And so he says, it's a line very famous, and those of you know, we teach this a lot in our community. He says, harmful beings are everywhere like space itself. Impossible it is that all should be suppressed. But let this angry mind alone be overthrown. It is though all foes have been subdued. To cover all the earth with sheets of leather, where could such amounts of skin be found? This is sort of pre-vegan days. But with the leather soles of just my shoes, it is though I cover all the earth. And thus the outer course of things I myself cannot restrain. But let me just restrain my mind and what is left to be restrained. So these are very, very powerful and yet simple words. And I read them because in the beginning of Lama Gangshar, that's really where he goes. You know, that of the three, our mind is most important, right? And as Shantideva points out in this very famous analogy, again, if the world was covered with thorns and one had bare feet, then what? Then every step is painful. And we could, you know, strategize a good solution, which is what? I'll just cover the whole earth, right? With sheets, he says, of leather. And then, therefore, my feet will be, they won't hurt anymore. Is that clear? And that's basically our strategy in life, right? If I can just control everything and everyone and make everything and everyone in life the way I want, then I'll be what? Then I'll be happy, I will never be angry, I'll never be impatient, I'll never be disappointed, I'll never... Because why? Because everything will be under control. Again, which is fundamentally impossible. And yet, it would involve a lot of work. But you would never achieve what you want. Why? Because in life, everything's impermanent. And everything is arising because of causes and conditions. Right? So it's a strategy in life that will only breed dissatisfaction. So he continuing his analogy, he said, how much simpler, right, to get yourself a good pair of shoes. Right? Then you could walk upon the earth with all its thorns and brambles, and your feet will not hurt. Right? I mean, very profound. And so what he's saying here is, when we understand the source of happiness and unhappiness and all the afflictive emotions and all the positive emotions is within our own mind, then I understand what? If I can just control, restrain, understand my own mind, I don't need to control and restrain everything else in life. Once you master your own mind, now I'm back to Lama Gangsha. Once you master your own mind, neither friend nor enemy will be able to benefit or harm you. If you don't gain control over your mind, then wherever you go, wherever you stay, attachment and anger will automatically well up. You must understand that your mind is the root of all joy and sorrow, good and evil, attachment and anger. Right? Very simple. And yet very profound. If we really take it to heart, if we really reflect on it, and if we really live by these words. And then he quotes a great Tibetan teacher from, I think, the 12th or 13th century, who wrote, when under the influence of Datura, Datura is like an hallucinogenic, when under the influence of Datura, all the various experiences you have, whatever they may be, all are in fact mistaken images without existence. Right? So he's basically telling, when you take some kind of psychoactive or drug like that, the experiences you have, even though you may be having lots of experiences, right, they're all basically what? Sort of hallucinations. They're all distortions. Right? So they have no real existence. They're not real. Right? And we know that. We'd say, oh, the persons, they're high on drugs. No wonder they're acting that way. Or they're drunk, or they're this, or they're that, or they're deluded, or they're, right? Because, and we understand that we even talk that way. That, drug experiences, psychoactive experiences confuse and distort reality. Is that true? We all accept that. Then he continues, likewise understand that under the influence of a confused mind, all the mistake experiences of the six classes of beings, whatever they might be, are all empty images, non-existent yet appearing. Since they appear in your mind and are constructed by your mind, exert yourself in taming this mistaken mind. So this is very fundamental, simple, but profound. Okay. So he's saying, in the same way that when one takes a drug, reality is distorted, right? And the person under the influence of the drug does not see reality as it is, they only see their distortions of reality, right? Just nod your head if you're with me. If you're not with me, just shake like that, and that will give me a sense of whether more explanation is needed. So you understand that. But then he makes this leap to say, our ordinary experience is the same. We think we're, seeing reality clearly, but our mind is distorting it. Right? We are confused in the same way the person under drugs and is confused because they think their hallucination or their delusions or their rational thinking is real, and so therefore they're acting on it. In the same way, we take our ordinary experiences of our mind that we experience day to day, moment to moment, and we consider that to be giving us, a real unblemished connection with reality. And he says that's not true. it is no different. Why? He says, because all the thoughts, feelings, projections that are arising, that are appearing in your mind, are not constructed by reality, they're constructed by your mind. I mean, very simple. And because this is what... So he says, since they appear in your mind and are constructed by your mind, exert yourself in taming this mistaken mind. So that, again, is why in the Buddhist tradition, the practices of meditation, calming the mind and stabilizing the mind and examining the mind are so important, because the mind is the root of what? Of everything. But especially it is the root of our happiness or unhappiness, our well-being or our ill-being. And if we care about those things, if we'd rather be happy than unhappy, right? If we'd rather have a peaceful mind than an agitated mind, if we'd rather have an open heart than a closed heart, you know, all those, right? Then we need to heed his words, which, again, that should really make you happy. Now, why should that make us happy? Well, think about it, right? For however old you are, right? Every day you get up and you are basically spending your day doing what? Covering the earth with sheets of leather, right? And then you go to sleep at night, exhausted, weary, and then you get up the next day, and what do you do again, right? And no matter what you do, every morning when you wake up, you have to do it again, right? Can you see the work that's involved in that? And it's never ending, because you see, wow, I got about 100 square yards of earth. And then you look out and you go, whew, I'm never going to finish this, right? And then all of a sudden somebody comes along and says, Fred, there is another way. Just take a little piece of leather and just cover the bottom of your feet. You see? I mean, wouldn't you be happy that somebody came along and told you that? This is easy. So, this is profound. He's telling us, oh, you know, all we need to do is learn to restrain our minds. And since our minds are right here, how easy it, I mean, how it can't get any easier than that. I don't have to go anywhere, I don't have to do anything, I mean, you know, I don't have to buy anything, it doesn't cost me anything. I mean, there are things to be done, but it can all be done right here. It can all be right done in my life, in my body, mind, right now. So again, even though these words are simple, they're pointing us in a good direction. Now, then he goes, that is how it is. But you shouldn't take your understanding from books or stories you heard from others, such as what you're just hearing from me. Instead, recognize for yourself that appearance is mind, and understand that your mind is the root of all phenomena. So these are like very profound teachings within Buddhism that he's just presenting very simply. Any questions up to now? Because it's very simple. That's what I appreciate about this teaching. Any questions up to now? Anybody want to take a strong stand for covering the earth with leather? I mean, you know, there could be lots of people in here who've spent decades investing in covering the world with leather and trying to control everything and everyone, and all of a sudden to be told, you know, that's not the way. you know, you may get, I don't know what, angry. Somebody's giving you this message. All these efforts have been for naught. Anybody attached to their covering the earth with leather? Just checking. Anybody not get what he's saying? I mean, don't be shy or have a question about it or it doesn't sit right. I'm expecting a lot from you now. No questions about meditation, no questions about the practice. This is very good. So then he says a very simple but important thing. Is that you're not just getting exercise back there? What is it, Rob?
Rob, I was arguing against the analogy, because in the context of analogy, it seems to be the problem. The analogy itself is where it breaks down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was this guy talking to this neurologist, and he's unbuttoning. He's buttoning his shirt
mm-hmm.
right hand, and his left hand comes behind him.
Mm-hmm.
He starts unbuttoning everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I swear it's not me.
Right.
Clearly it is him.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it seems like it's more like that when you run into problems with practice. It's not like, oh, you know, it's like when you come up with the intention to cover your feet, there's something that comes up underneath that sneaks up behind you and keeps, next thing you know, it's like it's taking your shoes off. And you're like, wait a minute, then I'll be going back to covering the props of leather again.
Right, so let me just summarize, because I think they're recording this. So if I understand you right, you're saying, hey, it's not so simple, Fred, right? It's just stopping to covering the earth with leather and just covering your feet because, you know, things are a little more complex and lots of things arise in the mind, you know, seemingly outside of your control. And you use the example of someone who's had some kind of neurological disorder or something and their bodies are kind of acting independently, right? Is that a good summary? Yeah, so one has to practice. It's not like you just get it, you see. Yeah, you have to practice. And the fundamental practice that we begin with is mindfulness, right? Just like you said. So if all of a sudden your intention is to unbutton your shirt and you notice that your other hand is coming along behind and you know, buttoning it up, you're aware of it. Now, which is different than somebody who has a neurological disorder, which is a physical disorder, which is, you know, so, you know, there is really, you know, I mean, again, I don't know. Maybe there are things they can do, but it's something where it's happening involuntarily and they have no control. We have control, but we are not aware. And you're absolutely right that some of this stuff we are so used to doing, it seems so automatic, right? That all of a sudden you just find yourself, you know, doing what you've always done. I understand. Isn't that what we're all dealing with? That's why we practice. We practice mindfulness. We practice awareness. We practice slowing down. Right, so we can notice what's occurring. That's the first step. We have to become aware and notice what's occurring within our mind. That in itself takes time to develop, that degree of mindfulness and attentiveness and examination. But that is the path. So if I was just basically saying, you know, you put down one set of tools. Right? The tools you've been using to cover the earth, and you put away all those sheets of leather, but now you have to, yeah, make yourself that single pair. Okay? That is the practice. But it's, I guess what I'm saying, it's a simpler practice because your focus is on your own mind. You're not watching everybody else's mind. You know, we're so busy watching everybody else's mind and watching everybody else's behavior and watching everybody else's speech and so concerned about everything and everyone, right? And so upset and angry and scared and this about and disappointed by everything and everyone that we never stop and to go, hold on, where is that anger, disappointment, fear, etc. arising? It's arising in my mind. So let me continue, okay? So thank you for that. I don't mean to oversimplify it. The concept is simple. The practice is takes a lot of diligence, okay? It's easier than controlling the world. That's what I'm saying. It's easier than controlling the world, okay? Learning how to make yourself a pair of sandals, Rob, will be a lot easier than learning how to control everything and everyone, okay? You don't have to do that anymore. But you still got to make yourself a good pair of sandals. That's true. So, he continues. In this context, you must distinguish between appearance and the perceived object. I will say that several times. In this context, you must distinguish between appearance and perceived object. A perceived object is the mere presence of a visible form, sound, or the like that is an object of any of the six types of consciousness. So, he says we need to distinguish between perceived object and appearances. And then he defines his terms. So he says, what is a perceived object? A perceived object is the mere presence of anything that arises to your six senses. Okay? So, this is the perceived object right now of your what sense? Your eyes, okay? So, it's a perceived object is simply whatever it is, the mere presence of a thing. And we'll slow it, you know, slowly, slowly, okay? So, the perceived object of the eyes is something we see, a sight. Perceived object of the ear is a sound, nose, smell, mouth, taste, body, sensation, and mind, which in Buddhism is the sixth sense. The objects of the mind are thoughts, feelings, perceptions, okay? So those are the perceived objects. Are you ready? Okay, so it's very simple. This is why it's like, that's why it's so good. Thoughts of attachment, anger, delusion, okay, fear, I mean anything, grasping, desire, like, dislike, right? Anything you say, these types of thoughts, attachment, anger, delusion, based on the perceived object, are appearances. So he's defining terms. Okay? So, this is simply this. It's a perceived object. We all perceiving, if we have good sight, all common experiences, we're all perceiving this object. Right? Now, whether you think they're beautiful, whether you think they're ugly, whether you like them, whether you don't like them, whether you have thoughts about them, whether they remind you of your own. At some point you had a, or you said, I'd like to get a vase like that. Or, maybe I should get some flowers on the way home today. It'd be nice to, you know what I mean? All that is appearing where? In the perceived object? It's arising where? It's, or as he says, it's appearing in our mind. Thoughts of attachment, anger, delusion based on the perceived objects are appearances. For example, the feeling of attachment to a pleasant object, the feeling of anger toward an unpleasant object, and the indifferent feeling toward something neutral. You must understand that such appearances are the functions of your own mind. You get this, and you are on your way. Everything that we know in life, we know them through what? Our senses, right? Our eyes make contact with objects, right? We see. Our ears hear sounds, our nose has smells, our mouth tastes, right? Is that clear? Those are just the bare experience of life. And yet, our experiences are being processed by what? By our mind, and all the things that appear in the mind about the perceived object. The problem is we confuse them. And we take the appearances that are appearing in our own mind as the thing itself. Like somebody just said to me the other day about their husband, I think. Well, you know, he sort of has a lot of irritable habits. I couldn't help but point out, you know, I don't know what he is doing. He's just doing whatever he's doing. The irritation, I mean, the irritableness is not in him. Where is the irritableness? Right? Take a guess. Where is it? What? In the mind of the person who's saying, oh, this person has a very irritable habit, right? No, the person just has a habit. The irritation is in you. But you see how we mix them up, right? Oh, this is not a very nice person. Anybody ever say things like that? Right, but no, the person is just a person. They're just doing something. The perception that whatever they're doing is not nice is appearing where? In our mind. Nowhere else. And not only that, the appearances may be very different for you than me. Right? And that has to do with everything. To know the reality of perceived objects and to accept that all the things that appear about the object are simply appearing in my own mind and nowhere else is the key here. You must understand that such appearances are the functions of your own mind. Due to mind, perceived objects such as form, sound, and so forth have appeared, but they are not mind. Why do these flowers appear the way they do? I mean, as a perceived object. In Buddhism, we say because of dependent origination, cause and conditions, right? These flowers are the way they are because of, you know, the seeds that they came from, their shape, their color, their longevity are all, you know, simply a product of all the factors that they depended on to come into being. I'm using an example of a flower because this is kind of easy, right? Is that clear? this is just arising because of causal conditions that, you know, as well as air and water and rain and who knows what else, and, the, you know, lots of causing conditions and the florists and the, right? But that's why this is appearing today as this. Right? Now, can you accept that? That there's nothing intrinsically good or bad or anything like that. You know, even to call it anything is something that our mind is doing. Does this call itself a flower? Does it know it's a flower? Doesn't have a clue, does it? It's just what it is. We call it a flower. We call it a type of flower. Right? We give it a color. Right, we give it a, we like it, we don't like it, we, you know. But this flower doesn't intrinsically have any of that, does it? It's just what it is. And everything else we are putting on it. Is that clear? Okay. Now let's try something else. Let's take Bill over there. All right, Bill, could you just stand up a second? All right, just stand. You don't have to do anything. Don't you have to sing or dance or do you? See, that is no different than this. Okay. He is there manifesting as he is right now because of what? Because of his causes and conditions. Right? You know, his body is the body his parents have given him. It's not his body. Even to call him Bill. I mean, he wouldn't have called himself Bill. It's a name his parents gave him, right? His parents gave him his body, his parents, and the way he is, his thoughts, his feelings, perceptions, and life have all been conditioned by endless causes and conditions. His family of origin, his upbringing, his culture, his religious, I mean, oh, so many things, right, have all conditioned that to be him. He cannot help being that. The same way this flower cannot help being the flower in this moment. Is that clear? They are not different. They are the same. We are all the same. Now, any thoughts we have about Bill, positive or negative, anything we could possibly say about Bill, positive or negative? Anything Bill could say to himself, positive or negative about himself? These are all appearing where? In his mind. They're not real. Right? Are they? And yet we mistake over and over again. The reality of the things that appear in our mind are the same as the object. We think all our thoughts about people are what? Come on, tell the truth. What? What do you think about all your thoughts about people in life and situations? What do you think they are?
Highly accurate.
Highly accurate. We might even say we think they're absolutely true. Is that true? Yeah, we all do. That's why he said earlier, it's a shared delusion. Right? Now again, somebody may have very positive, experiences with Bill, and therefore look at him with high regard. Somebody else might have had terrible experiences with him, and look at him, you know, oh, God. Has he fooled you? Right? Now, which is right? You see? See, there's no truth in either one of them, because everybody just has a piece of reality. So therefore, we understand that any thoughts we have about Bill, and we may have thoughts about Bill, positive or negative, are not Bill. They are simply our thoughts about Bill. They are appearing in our mind. You can sit, Bill, thank you. I mean, it's interesting right now, you know, in our historical time, we have a president, right? And many people have very different things appearing in their mind about him. Isn't that fascinating, right? And everybody thinks that their idea is what? True, valid, the truth. And yet, he, like this flower, like Bill, is who he is, isn't he? He cannot help being who he is. Why not? Because he is the product of his causes and conditions, just like this flower. Just like all of us. Just like everyone we know. Just like everything in the world. Right? We need to understand that. You know, in the big scale of things and in the little scale of things, just our most intimate relationships and friendships. Our thoughts about reality is not the same as reality. The things that appear in our mind have no real basis. How many thoughts have you had since you've been sitting here today? Anybody have more than one? How many thoughts do you think you've had today? Well, you're pretty good. You might have had hundreds, if not, yeah. And what have you noticed about each of these thoughts, individual thoughts? Are they real, solid, permanent things? No. What is the nature of these thoughts of yours? They appear and they disappear. They have no permanent existence. They just appear and disappear. And yet, we treat them like they're what? Real, solid things. Right? The things that appear in our mind, the appearances, are not, he says, they do not possess any true existence. Even our thoughts are just dependent on causes and conditions. What is your name?
Nuria.
Nuria, good. So I don't mean to put you on the spot, but if in these meditating, observing these thoughts coming and going, have you been in control of their coming and going? Like you tell which ones to come and which ones not? What? Yeah, you stop. Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm talking about. So they just seem to arise by themselves. Your thoughts have their own causes and conditions, don't they? Well, that's interesting. You're not consciously bringing them up or anything, are you? They just arise. I mean, that's fascinating to notice, isn't it? Because we often treat them like they're what? Yeah, what's really happening? Are they important? Are they giving me real information? And yet they're just arising on a random basis. Anybody ever notice they could have contradictory thoughts within a very short period of time? Right? Yeah, gee, I'm having a great meditation. It's really great. I'm having a terrible meditation. This sucks. You know, I mean, it's like, and that can all happen within 5 minutes or 10 minutes, can't it? And yet we might act as if that information is somehow has some kind of validity to it. Right? Somebody acts the way we want them to act, and what do we think? What? Yeah, what a great person. Wow. I'm so lucky they're in my life, right? You know, 30 minutes later, they're acting in a way you don't want them to act, and what do you think to yourself? What do you think? What? Jerk. Hey, what am I doing with this person, right? You know, I mean, that's the mind. And yet we take these things that appear just because of their own cause and condition as valid and true, and we act on them. Is that not true? So that's why cultivating a meditative mind is so important, because you're learning that, what? They just keep arising and passing. Good thoughts, bad thoughts, wanted thoughts, unwanted thoughts, they just have their own life. And in meditation, what are we learning to do in our mindfulness meditation? What are we learning to do with these endless things that are appearing in our consciousness? We're learning to what? Just let them be. Don't remember the instruction? Don't push them away. Don't pursue them. Don't be upset by them. Just let them come and go with their own. Just like sounds, just like sights, just like flowers. Just appreciate that. We don't have to judge it. We don't have to evaluate it. We don't have to compare it to the flowers that were here before, or right, or think about buying some, or, you know, we don't have to do any of that, do we? We can just what? Just appreciate them in the moment. We can appreciate Bill in the moment. We don't have to have an evaluation about him, an assessment about him. We don't have to, right? We can just, there's Bill. Just another perceived object. After today, you may want to remind yourself that all you're experiencing is a perceived object. And that anything you think about that is just appearing in your own mind. So let's take a moment to talk about this. I mean, this is kind of big. This is kind of, for many people in here, revolutionary. It's a totally different way of looking at life, and the mind, and yourself, and other people. Lots of implications to this. So let's take a moment to make sure we get this. And the Buddha said, hear my teaching, reflect on my teaching, then practice it. So we don't want to just kind of listen like a bowl that has holes in it, you know, where it just kind of comes in and drifts out, seeps out, right? We want to chew on it, make sure we understand it, that it makes sense to us, that it accords with our experience, our logic. And if it does, the Buddha said, well, then practice it. Put it into practice. But first, chew on it. Don't, you know, it's not for true believers. It's important that we engage, with the teachings so that they really make sense to us before we practice them. So, questions or comments about what's been shared in these teachings? Yes. Well, hold on. Yeah. So, yeah, makes it easier.
My question is this, yeah. On the object of mind being thoughts and mental experiences.
So you're talking about this, the way Buddhism psychology classifies the sixth sense as the mind.
Yes.
The thinking, perceiving, cognating mind. Right.
Right.
That's a consciousness.
And its object being
thoughts, feelings, you know, anything the mind that's, you know, that's immaterial, right? Like the eyes, you know, the objects can be seen, they're material things. But the thoughts and the feelings and the perceptions and the memories that appear in the mind, see, nobody else can, what is your name again?
Jude.
Jude, right, see, nobody else can see them but you.
Right.
You see, though they're very special. But only you can see them.
I think so.
All right, okay. Yeah, so those are the objects. So a thought appears, a feeling appears, a perception, a memory, those are the objects of your, yeah.
So the thing is, though, they're not different from the mind. I mean, I don't think they are. And my question is, if they are temporary, which they observably are temporary, and that is due to causes and conditions, which are not permanent, is that the same thing as saying that they are interdependent with other mental causes and conditions, that they're impermanent, like, and that the impermanence is not separate from their unity with the mind itself and all the other thoughts of the mind? Is that it? Do you think that that is the same statement, and is that the same statement in Buddhism?
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. So I think what you're saying is, so these thoughts that arise in the mind on their own, and the feelings and the memories, sort of when you're meditating, they just, right, and that you become aware of them now, right? So they're now the object of your awareness. You're aware you have a thought, you're aware you have a feeling, right? So these are also just arising, they're impermanent, and they're arising causes and conditions. And but he's also saying that in the same way, right? So let's say, Jude, a memory arises in your mind. Okay, a memory of something, a pleasant memory, right? Now, the pleasantness of the memory is not in the memory, it's in your experience now of that. So you are actually, things are appearing in your mind about this memory, right? In the same way, we have thoughts, right? And many of us, in relationship to our thoughts, things appear. You know, that's a pleasant thought. Let me grab onto it. There's an unpleasant thought. Let me push it away. But that whole pleasant, unpleasant is just more appearances. The thought is just a thought. It's just arising because of causes and conditions.
I guess I'm asking, isn't the thought itself just an appearance? Like the flowers, like, I mean, we conventionally observe them as flowers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they're also carbon dioxide and soil and sunlight and all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so are we. And so is everything else.
Right. So everything is fundamentally, yeah, everything is just appearing and has no substance.
So
all
that,
perceptions.
I hear an answer of yes, if that same way of thinking is applied to the thoughts within the mind.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Right. That is why we are learning to what?
To observe them.
To observe them. Without reacting, without needing to push them away, because we understand that they are just thoughts, feelings, perceptions that have no substance. So we don't have to do anything. Right? We think we got to get rid of them. We think we got to... But really, we just got to let them be. And they will what? Disappear. That is because that is their nature. Why? What does it mean it's their nature? They don't have any solidity. I mean, anybody ever look at a thought? Next time you have a thought, why don't we just stop now? Okay, everybody just close your eyes. And the next time a thought arises, just look at it. Tell me what you see. I mean, this is fascinating because we have been led around by our nose, by our thoughts, our whole life, right? And yet we've never, no one's ever said to us, why don't, you know, what is the nature of a thought? Right? So just close your eyes and just watch your mind. And, you know, next time a thought arises, just look right at it. You don't have to think about it. Just look right at it with the kind of, you know, like as if you're just trying to look at it and see, well, you know, what is it? Is there anything solid, permanent there in what I call a thought, or what you call a thought? Just watch your thoughts and just look at them. Are they solid, permanent things? How long do they stay around? One thought. Especially when you look right at them. So we're doing a little experiment. This is like a laboratory. Except the lab is in our own mind. Just look at your thoughts. Are they real, self-existent things? Or not? What are they? You decide. What is the nature of a thought? And then just watch until the next one comes. And then as it comes, just look right at it with that sort of inquiring mind. What is the nature of this thought? Is it a solid, permanent thing? Is it an entity that I can grab onto? What is the nature of a thought? To know the nature of one thought is to know the nature of all your thoughts. They're all the same. Just a few minutes more, just keep looking. Just as the thoughts arise and they continually arise, just kind of see if you can just look at one as it's passing. And look right at it with this kind of investigating kind of quality. What is this? What is its nature? This thought. Any thought, good thought, bad thought, high thought, low thought. Wanted thought, unwanted thought, whatever you want to call it. What is the nature of a thought? This is kind of turning your own experience into your laboratory of investigation. So I said earlier, you don't have to go anywhere, you don't have to do anything. You can just observe your own mind. That kind of inquiry. What is the nature of my thoughts? What are they? What is a thought? I mean, I'm not asking you for an intellectual answer. I'm asking just to look right at it. Anybody want to report back from the laboratory? Who's looked into their mind and looked at their thoughts? What do you see when you look at a thought? Yes? You're right there, right there.
It seemed like they were all opinions.
All what?
Opinions.
Right, that's the kind of thought. But I'm asking you, what is the when you look right at a thought, what is a thought? Is it a thing? Are those opinions solid things when you look at them? And you look right at them in your mind, Ellen. What do you?
It seemed to just disappear.
They disappear. Okay. Other reports back from the laboratory of your mind when you look at your thoughts? What do you see? Yes, sir.
Well, well, I actually thought it was an interpretation of reality, right?
Well, again, I'm not asking you to think about what your thoughts are.
Yeah.
I'm asking you just to look right at a thought. It's sort of like if I said to you, what is your name?
Dan.
Dan, if I said to you, Dan, you know, smell these flowers, you'd have to what?
Smell the flowers.
Right, but you'd have to get off of your seat and come over here, right? I mean, I mean, if you started going, well, I think they smell like that, or, you know, I go, well, Dan, come on, it's a little simpler than that, all right? So good. So what I'm asking you to do here is like that, is just look at a thought. Not how it is, not how it functions, but what is a thought? It's interesting. It's like the last question we've ever thought of asking ourselves, you know? Like, what is a thought? Because we have them all the time, and they run our lives. So why don't you look at your thought, even that thought of their interpretation of reality. When you look at that thought, it's an interpretation of reality. What do you see when you look in your mind directly at that thought?
It's nothing in particular?
It's nothing. It's no thing. Yeah, interesting. Yes, behind you in the green.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's not there. You can't find it. So I had an impression or a made-up idea of my thought, a picture, an image.
But
then when you actually look for it, it's not there. It's kind of like a...
Yeah, isn't that amazing? We think they're so real and important, don't we? Anybody else want to report back from looking directly at a thought? Yes, ma'am.
Mine were a little bit different. They were memories. A good memory, and then it went to a future memory that I wanted to have.
I understand. So I'm not, again, so this is, so that which you call a memory, mm-hmm. right, is that like an image?
Of something that happened.
Okay, but it's an image. But even to say of something that happened is to begin to think about it. So if I said to you, a memory is an image that arises in your mind, right? In other words, take out the context. It's just an image, right? Now, if I say, what is your name?
Maureen.
Maureen?
Maureen.
Maureen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Maureen. If you just looked at that image, just looked at the image, whatever it is, what happens when you look directly at that image? Don't think about it. Just look right at it. What happens?
It would disappear.
It disappears.
Wow.
Now, why do you think it disappears? I'm thinking of my grandchildren, you know, like the balloon. They think the balloon is what? A solid thing. So when it pops, what does a child do? What? They get what? Yeah, they get upset because they thought the balloon was what? A real solid thing, right? But, you know, it's like those soap bubbles, you know, the ones you blow, right? They're beautiful, right? And they just, because there's nothing there, is there? So it's interesting, isn't it? So that's what I'm saying. You know, it's hard for us because we think about everything, don't we? But this is not that. This is just stopping and just looking directly at a thought, a perception, a memory, just what is it? It's interesting. And all of a sudden you look and you see, what, Maureen?
Nothing.
Nothing. It's not a thing. It appeared, right? We don't deny that it appeared, right? We don't deny that the balloon doesn't appear to be what? A solid, round thing, right? But when you put a little pin in it, you realize its nature is what? Filled with air. And once that air is let out, what happens to the balloon? Falls to the ground. any other reports back from the laboratory of your mind? Yes, sir.
Thank you. This is a very valuable experiment.
Buddhism is very scientific. You know, it's not theory. It's not dogma. It's because, you know, just look into your mind and see what's there. It's like, it's evidence-based, we might say. Yes.
So it seemed to me like there was the process of thoughting, and then there is the engagement, which becomes thinking.
Yes.
So I was able to observe thoughting, but the moment that I engage it, it becomes thinking, and it's like the process of trying to make it into something.
Right, exactly right.
Yeah. So that was my experience.
Right. So again, that's why in Buddhism, everybody understand what the man said. He said he really could think, you call it thoughting, which means just thoughts are arising, right? But then when you engage with them in some kind of discursive way, then you're actually thinking, right? Is that clear? So there is that process of engagement, which is very important to notice, if that's what we're doing. See, we don't know that, right? In the same way, the way you call it, thoughting, right? We are just seeing, right? But once we like it, dislike it, start thinking about it, you know, now we are engaged with it. We're no longer just seeing, right? We're no longer just hearing. We're no longer just smelling, tasting, right? Even feeling, right? I mean, we may have a feeling arise in our body, our mind, right? And what do we do when we feel it? We what? What do we do most times? If it's a wanted feeling, we go what? Right? If it's an unwanted feeling, we go, and that's the engagement. And then it just gets murkier and murkier. But feelings are just like thoughts. They just arise and disappear according to causes and conditions. Right? I mean, anybody been around young children? Right? You watch a young child. When things are going well, they are what? Happy. Right? When things aren't going well, they are what? What? Unhappy or angry. But how long does their unhappiness or anger last? Well, hardly at all. As soon as things change, they change. So that shows you the uncontaminated nature even of feelings and emotions. They just arise according to causes and conditions. Right? But we do what? We engage with them. We grab on to them, we push them away, we struggle, we repeat, right? So what Maureen said, like, a memory comes up, good memory, she then, what does she start doing? Thinking and remembering other things, and before you know it, another thing, and another thing, another thing, right? Or, can you see? But all that really happened was, sort of on its own, a memory arose. It's interesting. Other reports back from the laboratory. Yes, in the back.
Not a report back, but a question.
Uh-huh.
So if I'm total control of my perceptions of Bill and that flower, then what do I do with that? I mean, you know.
Spoken like a good American. There it is, Paul. Right? It's like, all right, now what do I do? You see? Why do anything? You know, why not just, when you see a flower, just be with the flower? Right? When you're with Bill, just be with Bill. Just, you know, have an experience. I mean, what's there to do? What am I missing here? What should I be doing with this flower? I mean,
we we tend to operate in those perceptions, right? That I like Bill, I don't like Bill, I want to spend more time with Bill.
How come he's not spending more time with me? How come he's not my friend? I called him, how come he didn't call me back? I mean, what's wrong with me? Oh, and then you remember all the other people who never called you back, and you know what I mean? And you think it's all real. And all that is appearing where? In your mind and nowhere else. Bill is just, he's not even aware of you. He's so oblivious, right? He's just over there. Bill just over there in his own world, and Paul's over there just having this incredible drama about Bill. Can you see? And and we think it's real. I mean, I'm using this example, but we do this all the time. We think our thoughts are real. And we just fabricate, and we think they're real.
I guess what I was looking for was that we would substitute them with positive versus negative. Because it almost seems to me if you completely let go of everything, then you're just kind of an empty vessel of nothing. You're just...
Well, you may be surprised that that's not the case. But that is the fear, you see. Right? You know, it's the fear of an addict. If you've ever been around addicts, or if you've ever been addicted to anything yourself, when you talk to an addict or someone who's addicted to anything and you talk to them about not doing that anymore, their first response is what, Paul?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. What's going to fill that empty void? Can you see it? Well, there's lots of things. But that's very good. That's this unrealistic fear. Yeah, it's like, what happens if I just enjoy the flower as flower and Bill as Bill and, you know, just go through my day just being at ease with everything and just responding to everything without a lot of drama? So you're gonna miss the drama.
No, but even just sitting and accepting Bill as Bill, to me, that's an appearance.
Well, you're not gonna do anything. I mean, remember, as I said, traditionally these teachings were very developmental, they still are. There's a whole path here. Right? So what Lama Gangchar did, he goes, we don't have time anymore, right? You know, all the institutions, and he was correct. I mean, basically, the Chinese communists destroyed 10,000 monasteries, and put all the teachers in jail. You know what I mean? So he was right. He was saying the only thing that's going to keep Buddhism alive is that people practice it in their minds. And so he kind of put it all out there, right? So he skipped over a very usual part of practice, which is the cultivating of wholesome and the non-cultivating of unwholesome, right? He just kind of skipped, let's get beyond wholesome and unwholesome and just, see things as they are. But from the point of wholesome and unwholesome, right, rather than having a negative or an unwholesome, angry, hating, whatever thought about Bill, it's better to have a loving or an understanding or a compassion, yes. So there's a lot that's skipped over because of the nature of these teachings, but they're still interesting. So does that answer your question? Yes, did somebody in the back? Yes.
Okay, so those flowers did not appear here all by themselves. Somebody had to go to the store and make a decision on those flowers.
Exactly.
So if everything is a nothing thought, how do I make any decisions? Like I'm standing there and there's pink and yellow and orange.
Yeah. That's perfect.
How do I make a decision from that?
So we're not, as Paul was wondering, we're not just empty idiots, right? Yeah. We have a mind that can discriminate and discern, right? That's one of the functions of the thinking mind. And it can be used, such as somebody, what is your name?
Jill.
So somebody says, Jill, would you please go to the store and buy such and such a flower of such and such a color? Jill doesn't walk in there and, just kind of by the first thing that comes her way, right? She but that is not, that's at the time, you see. You see? Or there are times in our life when discernment and discrimination is beneficial, right? But the problem is we overuse that. It's going all the time. I mean, we just walk around the world making discriminating remarks about everybody, right? For what purpose? You see, that's, it's like out of control. And it's, and we think that all these discriminating remarks we make about reality is reality, right? So I'm glad you asked the question, which doesn't deny that at times when it's your place to discern or distinguish or make an evaluation, that you do. But
so you're saying we do that from a balanced position?
What? Say that again.
I mean, how do we, I've got the yellow and the orange and the purple. How do I decide I'm buying purple versus, you know, how do I decide I like Bill or I don't like Bill? Or, you know, from what part of the brain or the thinking does that come from?
You know, that really has everything to do with our understanding our mind is conditioned. Right? You know, again, you know, in Buddhism, when we talk about understanding, you know, like, let's just take our president, because I take our president because he's like out there. You know, it's like everything is disclosed, right? And many people think it's wonderful and many people think it's terrible. But the truth is that if any of us, probably, were born to his parents and raised exactly the way he was raised and had exactly the same experiences he's had, we might, and we may, some people may find this hard to believe, may have be showing up in life just like him, because he is simply a product of his causes and conditions. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean if you have a vote, you don't discriminate. But we have to understand that it's not truth. Right? And when people think their thoughts and beliefs are absolute truth, you know, you get the world we have today. People kill each other, right? I mean, hurt each other, do violence for each other, to each other, right? Because somebody has a different idea than they do, or practice a different belief system or religion or a political belief. I mean, it's dangerous. This believing that your thoughts, your feelings, your perceptions, your ideas are truth, you know? I mean, it's okay to say they're true for me. You see, that's humbling. Or this is my perception, you know? This is my perception of Bill based on my experience, right? You see, that's at least qualified. Right, so if somebody says, gee, I just met this guy, Bill, he's really this nicest guy, you know, and your experience is, that's not my perception. But I'm willing to say I have a different perception, not a different truth. You see, then it's an open book, because if I'm talking to somebody who says, oh, Bill is the nicest guy and I think he's the worst guy I ever met, then I'd be interested in talking with you. You know what I mean? Like, why... You know, what's your experience with Bill? You see how it's an open? It's open. It's willing to go, oh, maybe my perceptions are, you know, maybe I just had one interaction with Bill, and from that one interaction, I've kind of, you know, made up a story about who he is. I mean, how crazy is that? Is there anybody here who would like their whole life and the complexity of who they are reduced to one incident? Would anybody like that? No, you go, you know, I could be having an off moment. But you see, but we do that all the time, don't we? It's not healthy. So again, I think it's possible to have, to say, you know, I like purple flowers, but there's no truth in that. It's not like somebody who likes green flowers or yellow flowers, or, you know, is wrong. It's like, oh, we just have different because of causes and conditions. In Buddhism, we just say causes and conditions. That's kind of our little meaning. We really don't know. But we know there had to be a reason that you like purple. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Good. Any other questions about this? Yes.
I get the idea, the truth, that if, you know, that we are a product of our causes and conditions, and if I was brought up that way, I would be that same person.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it just kind of goes back to discernment, you know, kind of like her question, how do I choose? Do I want the purple mm-hmm. or the yellow?
Mm-hmm.
But there's always, you know, there's scientific obvious things too we can base things on, you know, like deciding that we can dump coal slurry back into our waterways is, you know, that obviously is not scientifically a good thing versus let's hire someone who tried to sue the EPA to now run the EPA. It's mm-hmm. different from, you know, there's
always because
science.
hold on, because you think the EPA should be there protecting the environment.
Yes.
Oh, that's your idea about how it should be run.
Yeah.
Raven, I hate to tell you, there are people who think that's the worst idea they've ever heard. Just let the free market operate and the environment will be taken care of. It's really do-gooders like you who've ruined this country. Now, what are you going to do with that? And they believe they're right. You going to shoot them?
I'd like to.
Okay, we'll maybe take that off the edited text. Raven, let me just tell you something. This is off the record. Those are things you might think to yourself, but you don't say them out loud.
I'm being transparent.
All right. Well, I'm just trying to, you know. But you understand. I mean, there you are. Now, just following your thought, what if they feel the same way about you?
I know they do.
Right, and then what kind of world are we? I mean, where's it going to end?
I don't know. It's just, where do you reconcile understanding that people are a product of their causes and conditions versus holding them accountable to their actions?
Yeah, it doesn't mean you don't hold people accountable for their actions, but you don't hate them. Because you understand they can't help themselves. You don't hate them.
But if
you understand they're just misguided, you know, from your opinion, they're just misguided, and you're going to do your best to what?
To understand it. But if we don't have clean air and clean water, really none of this matters, because we're not going to be around.
Well, you're still going to be around to smell the clean air or the dirty air. I mean, that's just still going to be a perceived object. Isn't it? I mean, here we are. Yeah. However this turns out, yeah, that's the way it's going to turn out, isn't it? You do what you can, other people doing what they can. I mean, you know, I mean, this is what we get for showing up in a world with 6 or 8 billion people, right? I mean, you'd be much happier in a world with just who? Just Raven and all the people who think just like her, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be an ideal world.
One big sangha. Breathing as one big sangha.
Yeah, well, we're doing our best to change the world, one person at a time. But yeah, I mean, that's the way it is. You know, I mean, you know, how many billion people are there? 7, 8? I mean, but that's the way it is. And, you know, they all have their own opinions and their needs and their wants and their desires and their, yeah, it's a, you know, when you think about that, it's amazing, you know, that things aren't worse than they are. Isn't that true? So we just do our best, right? You know, believe in what you believe in, stand up for what you stand in, but understand the context in which this is unfolding. That's what this is about. Buddhism is about big picture. When we understand the big picture, we can act wisely in the day-to-day.
I do understand it in the big picture, but I'm still not reconciling the actions of that with the big picture.
Well, that's why we practice. Yeah, this is, you know, I mean, you're dealing with a long-term way of thinking and believing, and it's very cultural. I mean, this culture is based on, you know, I am what I believe in. My beliefs, you know what I'm saying? Thich Nhat Hanh
said, so much. It's not like this is what I believe in. I mean, that definitely, I'm getting rid of that more and more.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's just science based. Really, you make.
There are people who don't believe in science. I mean,
you know,
get real. You know, a third of this country doesn't believe in science.
I know.
I mean, that's. What, you gonna shoot them? Oh. Don't say it. I mean, you know, that's reality. So the question is, how do you then, what, do you educate people? Do you dialogue with people? How do you, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, and we, that's what we need to talk about.
Education.
Well, yeah, but but you know, things are what they are. This is what we got. Okay. I mean, I wish it could be different.
There's always the argument that what does it even matter? Because the Earth will still be here. We won't, but it's okay.
Yeah. The Earth may be better off without us. Yeah,
agree.
That's very true.
Yeah, totally.
So there will be. So
we're really doing.
So there is some benefit to it all.
Yeah. Exactly.
The animals may be happier. You know, the plants may be happier.
Yeah, whatever's
left. Yeah, we have not been that great.
Cockroaches and the rats will be really.
Cockroaches
happy.
Will be free to go wherever they want to go. So there may be, it's serious, but that's true too. So it is 12:30, so let me just say some final words. So it's good to have these discussions, but they have to be practiced. Again, so what we're doing today in our day of mindfulness, in our day of being present to our own minds, is, you know, see if you can observe yourself. You know, like where it's a silent day, you're going to be doing mindful eating. See, can I just eat without generating all kinds of what? Thoughts, like, this is good. This, you know, it's like almost every bite we have to comment. As if the food is good or bad, is tasty or not tasty. That is simply what? Those are just appearing in the mind. It doesn't mean that you may not have a thought, this is delicious. But you know there's nothing intrinsic in the food that's delicious. Somebody else could be eating the same thing and hating it. And knowing that, you can relax. So watch your mind, see if you can really watch throughout the rest of the day the difference between, can I just see the perceived object as an object, and really distinguish between all that's appearing in my mind and then remembering that when you look at whatever's appearing in your mind, it disappears. This is more, everything's more open and spacious.